Accession number 18212, Reel 1.
Mr. Burke, Reel 1, where were you born, please?
I was born in a mining village in Yorkshire called Stainforth, which is 7 miles from Doncaster.
Which year was this?
1930.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Stainforth?
Yes, up to 1939, and then the family broke up because my dad had been called back to the army, and my mother couldn't carry on, my father came back in late 1939, early 14. We had to be put in a home, orphanage, near Huddersfield. And that, because none of the other family, because there were 7 of us, nobody else had ever, you know, the too big a family. Because my father was Catholic Irish, he was, and all his side was Irish. And then I got took seriously ill in this home, and I was at bed, ridden like, and nobody was allowed to see me. But one day I can remember my father coming. He was in warrant officer's uniform, as he was then. And he was throwing down reins, and this was right on the Yorkshire Moors. It was a desolate place, it was. And he was throwing down reins, and this nurse, she propped me up in bed, in my bedroom, so he could see him and I could see him. And that, after that, I got took into hospital, and I was in hospital then just over 6 months. But in the meantime, my grandma, my mother's mother, she came and found us and took the other 6 back to where she lived in Fish Lake, in Victoria College in Fish Lake, a little country village of about 300 people in it was then. And then after 6 months, she fetched me out from the hospital, took me home, and we stayed with my grandma then till I went in the army. And at 14, my grandfather, he was an official at the colliery, and he got me an office job, but I didn't like it. I didn't like the office job, so I wanted to be my friends down the mine where more money was. So I went down the mine without him actually knowing until after I'd done it. It was all, you know, done underhanded, like, to keep it away from him, like, with him being a top dog. And then I was about 5 years down, 19, down the mine, and I was a keen cyclist. I used to do a lot of racing and that, but I used to do 2 shifts, because this was the end of the war, when you wasn't allowed any shifts off unless you had a medical certificate. And I can remember once when I were earning 30 shilling a week, I got injured in my hand, and I thought the doctor had sent a certificate in, as they used to do, to the coal mine. This was before, when they were private, these were before they were nationalised, and he hadn't done, and I got 10 shilling, stopped, summons out of 30 shilling. So hard it was in them days. Anyway, I got a bit fed up of it, because there was no life down the pit. And that, so I went secretly again, without my grandma knowing. I rode to Doncaster and signed on. And then I went for an exam. And the sergeant who was taking the recruiting sergeant, he knew my father, because he says to me, "Are you Albert's son, Albert Burke?" So I said, "Yes," and because all his close friends used to call him Albert. His name was James Albert, and this sergeant was instructor. He was Irish too, and anyway, he helped me with the exam to pass it, and that's how I got in the army. And my father, when I seen it, he came home just after I'd enlisted, and that was the second time after the war I'd ever seen him, and he told me I hadn't to join the tanks where I had my eye on, and he said I had to go what was then the REMI, the electrical, the new electrical regiment was started up, you know, and that, but I didn't want that, I wanted the tanks, and almost put me out, I don't know why, on tank, being a tankie. Anyway, I in the August,
August of which year is it?
August 1949. I got on my bike without telling anybody, and I got my pass from Doncaster, from the recruiting office, near up back of the church in Doncaster it was. And then I got on the train, and I went to Darlington, and from Darlington I went to Catterick, and that's the... Then I went to the 1420th in Catterick at Crossroads in Catterick, and that was the very first time I was 19. That was the very first time I'd had a bed of my own in all my life, except when I was in the hospital. I loved the army. I did. It was in the blood, you know. So my uncles and that, they'd all been in the army. Granddad had been in the army, after I'd been in a few weeks and I'd done my training and everything, I was all of a sudden sent to Middlesbrough for a medical. I couldn't understand this because I was fit. And when I came back to a few weeks after this, squadron leader, the 2014-20, sent for me. And he said that I had to leave the army. And I couldn't understand this, and he wouldn't tell me or anything. Anyway, we had a real good discussion about this, and he were a gentleman. And he says to me, if you like the army that much, you know, we must help you. So what he did, a week after, he sent for me again, and he says, you can start, you know, I had my regular number, 22860095. And he said, you can keep on in the army. You're all right. So I did do.
But why did you like it so much?
Well, because when you're being fetched up and you were the oldest son of a big family and your mother and father had parted, you know, it was a terrible house. I mean, my father was a drunken Irish Catholic, as I call him, James Burt was, and he was always drunk. And that, you know, we never had no money, no food, anything, you know, no shoes. You know, we was poor. We was. And it was a rough life, and I'd had this from being, well, up to being 19. I mean, I had to go out to work. I went down a bit to get more money to help my brothers and sisters. But my father was keeping them in the army. He was good that way. They never went short. Everything he did extra in the army, he passed it on to my grandma for us seven, as it was. And then they all put the responsibility on me. It was my fault. The home broke up. It was my fault, and everything was my fault, you know. And I never had no actual pocket money. I used to put my money on the table, and my grandma used to give me what she thought back. And I was into racing then, and you know, I had never had no money like the others in cycling club, and that. And I got made a captain of cycling club. It was in the cycling news, and that I was the youngest. In 1946, I was the youngest ever captain of a big club. That was Thorn Paragon Club. It was a big, well-known club in the country. And that, and it was just degrading. Like, you know, the people had money and the captain didn't. You know, I used to have everything. And that, well, that's what I joined the army. I did it all secretly without anybody knowing, because I know that. And the thing is, I never knew till 2 years ago this. In 2 years, that's... 97. In 97, I was told that my grandma had wrote to the army, and it was that I'd left six brothers and sisters, and you know, and I was the breadwinner for them and all this and that, and of course she was a good letter writer, my grandma, and that's when they tried to get me out of the army, because I'd done it unranded to join the army. You know, well, yeah, same as I was saying, the squadron leader of the 1420th then, he was a gentleman to me because he fought it, you know, he said, no, you know, if you love the army, why the hell shouldn't you be in the army, you know, why should you be responsible for your father's and your mother's thing, like, you know, he must have been a family man and that, but he was a great man. Anyway, I stopped in the army, and then I got when I passed my training and everything, I was I was trained partly as a gunner driver on comets and I forgot the other tent, we had the small tent. And then I went to the 8th Hussars at Leicester, and I did a bit more gunnery there, and driving, lorry driving and everything, as everybody did in them days, you know, you and everything you passed, you got extra money for it, you know, as it was in them days, stars. You know, the army were in a bit of turmoil because they were changing around after the war and all this, you know. And I can always remember that we had collar dogs in the 8th Hussars, and it was said that our colonel wouldn't have collar and ties. We'd be in the old cavalry regiment. Anyway, while I was there, I think about 19, well, late 49, early 50, that Montgomery, he'd sent a letter and said, you will carry out the orders, you know, you will wear collar and ties. That's what we had to do. And they tell me this letter was put on the notice board. I can't remember seeing it myself, but that's what they said it was. And that was the 8th Hussars all over. There was a cavalry regiment, and the officers thought they were still cavalry, you know, and they run the regiment as they thought fit. And it was good. It was a real good regiment. It was. And you thought more of the regiment then than you did of your relations. You know, that was your, in my opinion, that was my home and everything, and I really loved it. And then after so long at Tidworth, there, I did two assault courses, what you volunteered for then, like, you know, and because you had a lot of spare time, you did force marches and all this and that. You did rock climbing at Saltburn near Whitby, you know, and all this, and night marches on the Goatland moors, you know, in Yorkshire and all this and that. You had a good life, but you only had 21 shilling to live on, and by the time your stoppage and everything, you had 10 shilling to live on. 10 shilling them days, you know, it was not bad at all. And so, and then after that, one day, a morning on parade, the squadron sergeant majors asked Mr. Cameron, they're calling, that was his name, Mr. Cameron, he asked any painters, and I was always told never volunteer, but my mate, he said he were a painter, and he put his hand up and he put mine up for me. And then next thing we knew, we were on the lorry going to Tidworth. We were the painting party, because these barracks hadn't been used for years. The government had no money to paint them or anything like that. So our colonel said we could do them ourselves, as usual. And we were sent to Tidworth, as named then, the painting party. And we painted all the barracks through and that. It was hard work and that, but it was enjoyable. And then the regiment came up then and took over at Tidworth about beginning of 50, I think it was. And we was in Moulton Barracks, if I remember rightly, and one thing or another. And then we were still doing training, shooting, that down at Lulworth Cove, Bovington, Salisbury Plains. We used to have a few weeks there, and it was good, very good. And then when this Korean War came about, all the reserves came back, and it was a funny thing. I was laid on my bed in my barracks one Sunday night. I was broke, so I couldn't go out or anything. And this man walked in. There was long barrack rooms, about 30 beds, I think. And this was the same man who I worked under, because he was what you called a deputy down the pit where I worked. And he'd been called up back as a reservist and that. And it was, you know, it was a nice meeting again and all this and that. And then all these other reserves, then we went to, we had to get up one morning early, and we fell in parade, and all the stuff had gone to Korea, like the tanks and everything. But in the meantime, we had an officer came being called back, and it was Mr. Eric Norris, and he was a great man. He was like a father to me. And of course, he says, like, when there was nothing doing, he says, I want a batman, you know, and that. So I volunteered. I don't know why, because I don't like them sort of jobs. But I volunteered, and I went to live in the batman's place above the officers' barracks, you know, right over in this little attic. It was like, as you know, in the early 80s and that, these servants living up in attics and all this and that, with a little bed. And I enjoyed it. And then when the Korean, we had to pack up to the Korean War, we packed all those things up and all that, and it was a bit sad and that, because, you know, all these things, what these officers had, they all had to go into storage just to their homes and that, you know, and one thing and another, and we were, Batman were packing the officers' stuff up and that, and it was hard. And then we followed one morning, we was up early and we fell in and everything, and full pack and all the lot. Then we were marched down in regimental strength down to Tidworth railway station, and all the people were on the sidewalk cheering us and that. And we'd never heard of the place called Korea. I don't think anybody in this country had known about Korea. Anyway, we got on the transport train, and then we went down to Southampton, and we boarded HMS Fowey, 19,000 and odd ton trooper it was, and we pulled out that night out of Southampton Harbour, and it were the view was marvellous, because the big liners Normandy was in, and another one, the, I don't know if it was Elizabeth or the Mary, I can't remember, but they was all lit up and they were all flashing the lights and that, because we were going out, you know. It was it was tea jerking, it was, for all those young lads and for these reservists who'd fought in one war, you know, and that. And it was something that people never forget. I know one man, he jumped overboard and tried to swim it back, but I think he got caught, and that one at reservist. Anyway, it took us just over a month to get to Korea. It did, and we landed there early hours of the morning. It was foggy, it was 30 below freezing, and everything. I never had an overcoat, because somebody pinched it while I was in England, and I didn't report it because it had cost me £9. And I, same as I said, I wasn't on that kind of money. So I used to borrow somebody else when there was inspection on, when I was in England. And before we were allowed ashore, these Korean girls came up with these baskets of big rosy apples. Biggest rosy apples I've ever seen in my life. They were beautiful. And they give us them, one apiece like us, threw one to us and that. And then over the tannoy, all of a sudden, there came a captain's voice. This is the captain speaking. Do not eat those apples. We have been informed they have been poisoned. And but most of us had eaten apples. And it was quick, because when it was breaking daylight, you're seeing all these apples and all these cores of apples in the sea, all floating around the boat, you know. And that cheered us up a bit. We had a good laugh about that. Then we were marched off.
Do you think any of them were poisoned?
Well, I've never seen anybody ill. I mean, I enjoyed mine, because I hadn't seen apple for a long time. And it was lovely and juicy and cold, it was. And then we'd embarked, and we had the American band there, and they all had silver helmets on, and they were all coloured troopers, there was. And they were marched up and down the dock, and they were playing When the Saints Come Marching In. And it was great, that time in the morning, and that. And then marched us off, and we went down, marched us to a place, what they call the Japanese war camp, as it had been in the war, and that. And it was disgusting. There was no roofs on them hardly. There was glass all over, glass broke, and everything. And the barrack room we were took into, well, it was only a note, we'd got took into, there was one table, and we had to sweep all the floor up and everything to get, you know, so we could sleep there. We were all tired, we were. And after clean up and that, there was this one table, and everybody was fighting, oh, we're going to have this table to sleep on. I lost it, I mean, because I wasn't the smallest man there. I was only 8 stone then. And then these reservists had to show us how to make us sleeping bags up. We'd never been taught how to put blankets in a sleeping bag. And we had these flimsy sleeping bags. There was like a plastic thing. That's all there was. It was terrible. No padding, just a plastic. bag like, coloured, and his reservist was showing us humans how to fold us as blankets, roll them up, then put them inside, roll your sleeping bag back, then push your two blankets. I think two blankets we had, or three blankets, or so. That's all we had. And anyway, gradually we got them all done, and we, I think everybody slept that night. You know, it was that cold and that day, and that. And then I can remember being on guard the next night. There was two of us being a reservist, and there was all our shells and that in, all piled up, you know, for tanks and that in this compound and that. And we was told like to shoot, you know, at anybody who was in this compound, because they said there was a lot of spies, you know, infiltrating and all this and that. Anyway, early hours of morning, we seen somebody, and I just took a round off, you know, and that. Anyway, we caught this, the other chaps on the other side, military priest, they caught this old man, and I felt sorry for shooting at him, and I was up on orders for doing it. But I mean, I got let off. But this old man, all he wanted was his shell case for a chimney. That's all he wanted, one of these. It was a favourite thing, these, because they were about that big shell case, you know, about 4 foot and about a foot in diameter. And all he wanted, this case, was for a chimney, you know.
Was he allowed to take it?
No, oh no, no, he wasn't, no. But it was a shame because they were that poor. I mean, nobody had ever seen a country like this. Nobody. And it was, they were so poor and everything. You never seen, I never seen a smiling face hardly. Only went to youngsters, used to run up to us and ask us for sweets or chocolates, you know, anything and that. And all the little kids and that. And it was then, I don't know, a few days after, they got the tanks loaded onto flats on the railway to go up to Pyongyang. And we set off to Pyongyang, our squadron mostly. That's A squadron, our squadron, Irish R. We always call it R squadron. Not A squadron, we call it R when we're talking. Actually, you're going into trouble if you didn't. And because it was an Irish regiment, you know, built in Ulster, so it was formed. And we got on the train, and it could hardly pull it, this old train, and that, and they feed it with wood and all sorts, logs, anything they could get. And after first night, I think it was, or second night, I was took off, not just me, there were two or three of us, and because the road transport, as they was going up, they was getting shot at, ambushed, and that. And because the Americans had gone straight at the main roads, you know, and they hadn't thought about the flanks. This was Thingy's idea, the great General...
MacArthur,
straight there. And they forgot up the flanks, you know, and they'd gone right up to Pyongyang, as there was then. And they were getting shot at. Anyway, I got took off, and I had a Bren gun on this three-ton wagon. And the first person I seen ever in action was up at a place called Taegu. It was a big airfield, it was deserted. And I think where the Northumberland Fusiliers, they had the first casualties there in ambush. And that was the first time I'd seen a wounded soldier on a stretcher and that. And I don't think it's ever gone down in history, it's ever gone. I mean, you talk to your mates, they know about it, but outside they don't. Anyway, the two or three wounded, and we carried on then, and it was terrible, cold, and we had no warmth hardly. The lorry had to keep stopping, and that, in convoys, because there were more than us up road. There were some American transports up road and all this, and supplies going up and everything, and it was only allowed up road at certain times, you know, the supplies come first. Anyway, we got to Pyongyang, and it was terrible. Being flattened. Only place just about there was the marshalling yards. Big marshalling yards there was. And we found a place, in one of these old railway sheds, where we could get some sleep. And we all got in this big shed. There was no roof on it hardly, concrete floors. And we made this, we got a big bin, big petrol bin, and we started a fire, you know, to get warm and that. And we'd all fallen to sleep. It must have been about 100 or just over 100 hours. At about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, we was all woke up, and it was bitterly cold, it was. And there was a voice says, gather round. And we all gathered round, and all in his dirty uniforms and that, because we never took him off to sleep in because of the cold and that. And Colonel Phillips, Jumbo Phillips, as they used to call him, he came in, and he stood on this box, wherever it was, and he told us, some of the words he said, if I remember that, we don't forget, we're the 8th Hussars. The Chinese are coming into the war, and you're going to be odds of 8-1 at least. But 1/8 Hussar can beat any wogs, you know, Chinese chinks and all this, they call them. And one thing another, and then, right you are, cheerio. And the next day he flew home. And, you know, it was disgusting. How he'd woke us up and all this and that after, you know, a fortnight on the road or more, stuck in a lorry and that. And I tell you, we all got down again to sleep the best we could. And then Sir Guy Lather took over then as colonel. Gentleman he was. Beautiful man he was. And we moved then the next day up onto a river. I think the River Pomath, I'm not sure what they call it. It was north of the city of the Pyongyang itself. And we got the tanks all into places for action and that. And then all these troops who were retreating from the Chinese and North Koreans, they was coming through us. We was there with the Northumberland Fusiliers up on one side, and we and others was on down by the river, and all the troops was passing through us. And that is the day I become a man, because this twisting road, all of a sudden there was these young men coming across from the north, from the Middlesex and Argyles, who'd been up in action on the Yellow River. They were coming through us, and they'd had nothing to eat for a long time, and they was all in disarray and that, and it was terrible to see these young National Servicemen, most of them, in the state there was, with the 303s and Sten guns. And we built a big fire, and we had some brews on, and they're coming down, them who couldn't manage it, and we were giving a cup of tea, and they were talking and that, and the eyes, he looked at the eyes, and it was terrible to look at, there was. And and then there was a jeep came down, and driver, he was a bit of a shock state, and we give him a drink, a strong drink and that, and we had him warm around fire, because it was 30 below, you know, it was very, very cold, everything was solid frozen. If you put your fingers on a lorry or a tank, your skin come off.